This week's episode of Still Entitled is made possible with support from M&M's new Hazelnut Spread Chocolate Candies. Spreadsheet and emails got you bogged down? Grab yourself a treat with the new M&M's Hazelnut Spread Chocolate Candies, guaranteed to deliver a delicious combo of hazelnut spread and milk chocolate in every bite-sized piece. They're a perfect way to bring some fun into your day. M&M's new Hazelnut Spread Chocolate Candies are an instant classic, unlocking a side of indulgence that's all its own. Even as I'm doing this ad read, my mouth is salivating because I'm thinking about the hazelnut chocolate spread. And I grew up on hazelnut spread chocolate, eating it directly out of the jar out of college, and now it's in a convenient package that I can take on the go and snack on. Go hazelnutty and try the new M&M's Hazelnut Spread Chocolate Candies today. And thank them for sponsoring this week's episode. Welcome to Still Entitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Norm.
I'm Adam.
I'm Zach.
And I'm Jeremy.
Zach and Jeremy. So good to see you guys this morning for the podcast.
It's great to see you too. First time I'm on this podcast.
That's ridiculous.
Wow. The timing worked out. We're actually recording our other podcast shortly after. So, but... we have both of you here, but both of you worked on the most recent episode, or one of the seventh episode.
Actually, the very last episode.
Yeah, of Savage Builds.
We did.
Dogfight Derby.
They aired it as the penultimate. It was the second to last.
Oh, they did. They did Food Fight last.
Yep.
Oh, fascinating.
But probably the episode that you're most hyped about, the one that's... It took a lot to get together.
Oh, my God.
And we're going to hear a lot about the process. But... Adam.
First of all, I'm sorry for my movie trailer voice, because every summer I get a cold. So I'm waking up with a movie trailer voice. I have a little bit of a cold. And that's because my friend Philip Atiba Goff, I did a sort of, not a fundraiser, but a friendraiser here in the cave for his organization on Friday night. And his organization is the Center for Policing Equity. And it is really cool. And when you hear about it, you're going to want to call yourself a justice nerd, because it's awesome. CPE basically uses data to help teach police departments how to better serve their communities. Nice. So they've been doing this for 15 years. They've got over 200 police departments they've worked with. And what they do is, so let's say a police department has an incident in which a white cop shoots a person of color. That police chief gets on the online and starts to think, how do I make this situation better? What can I do to stop this from happening? And CPE is one of the first links they find when they go look for that. And CPE comes in and says, well, I think what the police stations might be afraid of is that CPE comes in and says, you're all racists. You got to heal that. And instead, what they do is they say, look, we're not here to retrain police to deal with their racial bias. That is something that is really, really deep and really hard to treat and attack and deal with. What we can do is we can look at your policies and see where they're leading to bad outcomes. And we can isolate which bad outcomes are your responsibility and which ones are not. Mm-hmm. And they have tremendous results coming in and doing this, because the police departments want this. They, like, you know, everyone who becomes a cop, I think, became a cop because they wanted to be a hero. Hmm. I think that's a central ethos going on here. And they come in and they work with the chiefs. Again, they have this tremendous track record. And it was a gathering of a lot of Bay Area folk and some wonderful people. And Philip left me with a little bit of his cold. Oh. So thanks, Philip.
Gift that keeps on giving.
But it was, again, it's super inspiring to be working with a group that is having genuine results in the world. Like, absolutely. You know, it's hard to find solace in this current time. And it felt like being somewhere where I was part of the solution. So that was awesome. Yesterday, I spent the day at JPL.
Oh, so much fun.
Which, because the Mars 2020 lander is being assembled for its flight in about 350 some odd days. And this is this brief period of time of 3 or 4 weeks when all of the parts are in one place.
Oh,
and so okay. In the clean room at JPL, they've got the descent stage, they've got the sky crane, they've got the main rover, and it's all folded up and it's upside. I literally was watching guys in bunny suits, like, using a torque wrench to carefully tighten bolts on the... It's so magical. Like, these guys are going to send this thing to another world where it's going to use AI to figure out where the hell it is. And we got the deep lowdown from my friend Adam Stelzner about how the drills, you know, all, yeah, It was almost overwhelmingly thrilling. I got to see the Mars Yard.
Were you allowed in the clean room?
I was not.
Okay.
I was not.
Is there a viewing area?
Yeah. So, yeah, there's a walkway. Catwalk. That's what it's called. So I got to stand up there. And I stood up there long enough that people in bunny suits noticed me, and some of them were taking pictures of me in the catwalk.
That's so
I'm
nice.
Like, the most interesting thing in this room is behind you.
Right.
So they're doing the sky crane.
They are.
And,
I believe, don't quote me on this, okay. I took a lot of information in yesterday, and so some of it might come out wrong.
Yeah.
But yes, they are doing the sky crane plus the retro rockets.
Yeah.
Plus there's some beautiful strain relief within the wheels of the rover. Plus, things that they learned on previous rovers, like the difference between rock that's been pummeled by water and rock that's been pummeled by air, have radically different, obviously they have radically different, shapes when you look at them under a microscope. They just, I think for the first couple of rovers, they were unprepared for how damaging they would be to the wheels.
God, it felt like Curiosity was just yesterday when that launched. And now it's been there for so long. And we talk about the wheels, like photos of Curiosity's wheels, all those big holes in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Every iteration, they learn so much more.
When you're at JPL and you realize, it's just like they said, they're as full up with people as they've been in a long time. It's like 6,500 some odd engineers there. And you think, that's it? Like, given what these guys have done, how many amazing things that they've done and sent things to other worlds and to the outer solar system, it's totally amazing.
And their success rate is just amazing.
It really, really is.
It's great.
The only time I've been to JPL is during one of their open houses, which I think they do annually, where anyone is allowed to come. And it was the year that they revealed that 6 minutes of terror landing video.
Yeah. So good.
And I just remember thinking that the most amazing feat of engineering is not even happening on our planet this year. It's amazing.
That filmmaker was walking around. He was making a movie about what they're doing now. Mm. We ended up having a really lovely discussion, which I think you guys would have lots to say about how organizations, when they form, they always want to be able to do projects in a single pass. But there's a level of complexity past which you have to accommodate for more than one pass at this. That, like, no matter how much pre-planning they do, there's always going to be things they discover in flight testing that they could never have prognosticated in the early stages. And, the challenge for every large organization like JPL is how to accommodate those late stage changes. I talked to them about what Andy Stanton told me that I quoted him in my book at Pixar. Like, Andy says, you know, the thing here, so he told me that the idea that the Scream was the currency of the world in Monsters, Inc., right, the central ethos of the film, was way late in the process of making the movie. And once they came up with it, they realized it was so important. They had to change all of this parts of the movie to accommodate that. But it was important enough that they did. And Andy's like, look, you go to investors and you get a couple $100 million and you tell them you're going to dig up a T-Rex. And then after 4 years of a 5-year dig, it turns out you got a Stegosaurus. Do you have the balls to go back to your investors and say, you know what we got? We got a Stegosaurus instead of a T-Rex. And Pixar has institutionalized that model of being able to do that late stage understanding.
Which is tough. I mean, that's exactly a workflow that is, you commit to things and you have to have months in advance because you can't go down a path and just change, but they can.
Because things go wrong at the last minute all the time, unless we're putting laser tag on World War I airplanes. And then everything works the first time.
Oh, man. Well, your first time. First times are all relative, aren't they?
It's totally true.
So let's set this up. The episode Dogfight Derby on Savage Builds, the 7th episode, which you can watch now on YouTube TV, Philo, Discovery Go. It's an idea that you had discussed with Peter Jackson the last time you were there.
The last time I was down in New Zealand, Peter took me out to the Hood Aerodrome and let me fly in a couple of his planes. Took me up for flights. Gary and Bevan, his two lead pilots, were just lovely human beings. And I mean, it's intoxicatingly magical. You got to fly.
I got to go up.
And
yeah, especially the landscape, right?
Over the patchwork quilt of New Zealand, which is literally like a Disney dream landscape come true.
Yeah.
And, you know, Peter's super... one of the things about him that's so amazing is obviously he makes these incredible movies in order to give people transformative experiences. But also as a person, he wants to do that for his friends too. So he, like, when I'm up in the plane, he's driving Norm and Joey over in the viewing van, the modified.
He's driving the
he's
van.
He's driving oh, yeah. the
Let's
double-decker
all
bus.
Jump in the van.
Yes.
This is a van that was a London bus that was turned into a transport vehicle that now it's part of his collection.
And he did the transformation. So he took a London bus and then painted it the correct color and then overpainted it olive green so that the original bus color was showing
through. I mean, it's all about the experience. I mean, that's the whole thing. It's from the moment you walk in that door.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
And he got excited because once you were in the air, he had a surprise.
Yes. And so on that first flight I did, he sent a Fokker DR1 after me. And I have this unbelievable photo of it coming in the distance. And I said to him at the end of that day, you know, it'd be really nice to have a real dogfight. What if we put laser tag on this? Because I know that Peter and his family play laser tag on their property. And I thought, that's a great pastime. He's got a big old property. There's lots of places to hide and super awesome stuff. Let's do this in planes. And he was like, a nanosecond. He was like, yes, please. Let's totally do this. So, Discovery ended up, I had to actually go to Discovery and beg for a bunch of dough to go to New Zealand.
I recall, this episode was not even greenlit until after other episodes in the series had been shot.
Indeed. And we had a backup. We had a backup for the money we had left in the bank. But I went to Discovery, went to the head of Science Channel, and I said, look, this one's really important to me. This is a once-in-a-lifetime thing, and we're literally building a time machine. That's what we're building. Yeah. And Discovery ponied up the dough, and we went down there. So then we went down. You guys did a whole bunch of previous testing before showing up, including, well, I mean, the biggest problem you guys isolated, was the RF interference from these giant ancient engines.
Well, we heard about that. I mean, like, sort of meeting one, you know, after we got kind of greenlit at the last second of like, okay, we're going to do this and we have 3 weeks to do it. You know, the first talk with the guys in New Zealand, you know, we kind of described what we were thinking about. And they're like, oh, well, you can't use radios. You can't use most electronics. You can't do anything around these engines because everything that we've tried has gotten interfered with. And we're like, oh.
Yeah, right. So these engines are basically, the whole engine turns on some of these planes. And they can't actually talk to each other between planes using standard aircraft radio.
It's completely unshielded. They have two magnetos. They have a completely unshielded system. Like, it's just all of these things kind of built up. I mean, they didn't have to worry about that back then.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the first thing that I said was, well, I need an airplane to just kind of test with. So fortunately, they were able to find one in Texas.
And that was not easy to find.
No,
either.
There's not too many of them in existence. No. So I flew down with like my prototype electronics and just kind of like, I just want to hold them next to the plane to make sure that they even function at all. And I was really nervous that, you know, that it just wouldn't.
We were all really nervous.
So, like, in previous episodes, you know, when you approach a build, you have an idea for an episode, like, you know, for example, Meteorite Sword, you basically have the idea of how you're going to do it in your head going into it, right? It's something that you know can all the variables are known.
Not only that, you actually have the idea of the things that can go wrong and the things that can't go wrong.
Right.
For instance, if we go into the meteorite build, we spend a few grand on a piece of meteorite, we spend a few weeks honing it, hammering it, folding it into a sword. If at the end of that episode, when we do the final tempering, that sword cracks in half, that's fine.
Yeah.
That is, we still have a great episode.
It's the process.
The flow chart, right? There's a flow chart of possibilities that all of those paths can tell a good story.
Right. But in 13 years of Mythbusters has taught me to smell out the things that will not let you have an episode if it doesn't go right. And if for some reason our electronics are 100% not working when we get to New Zealand, there's no other option. What, are we going to shoot dart guns at each other?
Right.
That was so my fear for 3 weeks. Like, I was up all night worrying about that. So, yeah.
But it ended up being like actual laser tag because if radios could have worked, would you have gone with radios?
Well, when we were brainstorming about it, we were talking about different ways of doing it. We were talking about radio. We were talking about doing it optically. We were talking about doing a bunch of different kind of technologies.
Well, part of the concern is these airplanes are precious, and we don't want to strap cables to them if we don't have to.
That's
right?
The other part, is that every single one is unique, and like, we kept on seeing and flying in planes where they would go, yeah, this is the only one in the world that flies. And these are made of paper and canvas and wood, and you're like, you can't tape something to
it. Exactly.
Yeah.
And the weight balance is very, very you know, accurate.
Yeah.
And so we don't want to disturb that. And
all
so,
of those things.
Well, yeah. And there's no interior walls where wiring runs through. There's just the canvas outer shell. And then when you're in there, you can easily, like, affect an aileron by bending your knee in the wrong way.
Oh, mm. Absolutely. I mean, everything is exposed.
Yeah.
So
one of my favorite, most messed up possible features of the plane is that from the gunner's position in the British RE-8, which was the plane I was in, I asked, what is the contingency if the pilot dies and the gunner doesn't? And they said, oh, then if you look down at the aileron cable, you'll notice it has a wooden handle bolted onto it. You can, if you need to, take this baton off the side, jam it in the floor, and that gives you throttle, and you can grab the cables for the ailerons and physically manipulate them to land. It's basically...
While facing...
Yeah. This is basically this is better than just dying.
it gives you something to do before you die. Exactly. It's really what it is.
I'd ask the pilots, like, have you ever landed the plane? And they're like, oh, no. No. Why would we try that?
Wow. I think the planes are hard to fly with the actual controls. I can't even imagine how hard they are with that.
And actually, something that what you just said was something I didn't understand until we were there, is they kept on talking about how unstable these planes were, specifically the Fokker, and why that made them excellent fighter planes. Because stable means that when you get it into a position, it stays in that position. So it's easy to fly because it accommodates some level of slop. But unstable means that every movement you make transfers to the plane very quickly, and that makes them agile. Right. So the less stable the plane, the more agile it is in the air. I totally didn't get, even down to the idea that the Fokker's shorter wingspan makes the moment arm less so that it can actually shift its rotation on a much shorter time space than the RE-8 can. All of that was like, it was a great physics lesson in World War I flying.
What I enjoyed from watching it so much, the episode, was I grew up with Top Gun, and so I'm used to distance dogfights, right?
Yeah.
And you guys, you could have thrown a rock at each other.
It's when you realize that these fights would occur between two people who are doing the same thing. They have the same kind of training. If they're really good, they have the same kind of passion and love for their machine and their co-pilots. And yeah, they have to shoot at each other from a distance that's like less than a city block to get accurate with the guns.
That's amazing.
Right. Yeah.
And at those speeds, all of those actually work to your benefit if you're doing an optical-based laser tag system.
Sure.
Yes. It turned out that the maximum distance we could operate at was just about the focal distance of the way the gun's aiming reticules were set.
Wow. Yeah.
That worked out. Really, that was not planned. That was just a lucky happenstance.
A lot of things lined up in this one.
And it allowed for the filming of it to look extra exciting when something's about 150 yards away.
That was a really interesting one because we had this wonderful pilot, John, who has, I don't think he's 70, and he has like 60 years of flying experience.
Yeah, I don't know how that works.
He's been
yeah.
flying since he was a child. And we attached a red camera to his wing and gave him the monitor in the cockpit. And he came down from the first flight like glowing, like, I've never flown like that. And it was really awesome.
Wow.
We gave him a cameraman credit in the episode because he really was contributing significantly to our storytelling of keeping the planes in this kind of frame. And it was one of my favorite parts about watching these guys choreograph, because what we would do is we choreographed the arrival of the planes to each other, and then it was everybody's guess. But in that arrival of making sure we've got the coverage, he would be walking on the grass with the other two pilots going, okay, then we're all going to move forward. Okay, then I'm going to bank right. And they do this like little dance maneuver with each other so that when they're in the planes, they would have it down.
Was that third plane typically above you guys? And
it was all over the place.
All over the place.
It was frequently to our side, but at a certain point, it came around to make sure that we got like two planes shooting at each other. Basically, we had a list of shots we knew we needed for the storytelling of the dogfight almost no matter what happened. And that's what we spent the early part of our practice runs getting down.
And that third plane was a two-seater?
Yes, it was.
With a cameraman?
Saws as the cameraman, but also the wing cam.
Gotcha.
But you were saying how, you know, the John came back as, you know, super giddy. I remember the first time you came back and the other pilots came back, the first time of actually being able to play the game with laser tag. The pilots, they started out so stoic and so just like, you know, kind of standing back, sort of, I think, a little unsure about us goofballs are doing to their airplanes.
Yeah, totally.
And rightfully so. Yeah. But then once we actually like got it all hooked up and they got to do it, they were just like little kids in a candy shop. I mean, and everybody was. I remember that first flight. It was late in the day. It was just literally like a test it the first time. And it was, you know, golden hour.
Oh, my God.
And it just was so beautiful. And I'm just kind of waiting here with the crew on the ground going, I don't know what's going to happen. It may not work at all.
Right.
But you guys came back and just were laughing. And it was just such a like a 80s movie moment where like everybody's like, yes, it works. Oh, my gosh.
It was exactly like that. And not only that, like you said, the golden hour was that like sunlight was dappling through the late afternoon clouds and creating this patchwork of sunlight on the landscape. And part of my producer brain was going, this is so beautiful. And the other part was going, there's no way tomorrow's flights are going to match this. We won't be able to intercut. And amazingly, they did.
Oh, New Zealand.
I know. Wow. And the pilots, Gary and Bevan, were both telling me, because both of them fly all sorts of vintage aircraft. I mean, Bevan, sitting on the coffee table in the mess room was a picture of Bevan flying a P-51 Mustang, wow. Right? Like waving to the camera. They read a lot about the pilots' personal accounts of flying these planes. They feel a real simpatico, a historical simpatico with their forebears. And they came down from the dogfight. All three, each dogfight we did solidified for them more. They're like, we're starting to really, really get what we were reading that we never understood on this visceral level before.
Wow.
And by the last flight, Gary, my pilot, was so confident of my ability to stay in. Because my gunner's position, there's no seat there, really. I have a cable from my waist to the ground, and I'm standing on a serrated wooden board. And so he was treating me with kid gloves for the first flight. By the third flight, I'm like holding on for dear life as he's pulling negative Gs that could toss me out of the plane. My mom just texted me that was a really scary episode for her to watch.
Yeah, no, it was amazing just to see the whole process. It was just so good.
But so the system is so impressive because we had these 30 sensors distributed across two planes with four separate guns, right? Mm-hmm. Three guns. One on each of the planes facing forward for the pilot's gun position, and a third one for me on my Vickers. Was I on a Vickers?
RE-8.
Yeah, right, I know. But
the gun itself.
The gun itself. I can't remember. Yeah. Sorry, everybody. Yeah.
But the modified gun with the gas blowback.
With a gas blowback and four separate channels of reception, because we placed some sensors on the wings, because right. You could riddle the wings of these planes with bullets and nothing would happen to them.
Right, right. Non-lethal hit.
We had non-lethal and lethal, and separate between pilot and gunner, and then you had a special one on your plane to detect whether you hit the tail.
Yes, because it's very plausible in my gunner's position to shoot off the tail of my own plane.
Right.
Especially since one of the Fokker's go-to moves is to park underneath my tail so I infuriatingly can see him right there. I can probably like toss a bottle of ale at his head, but I can't hit him with my gun.
Yeah, yeah. So we had to come up with a system that was totally flexible and it just kind of had to work with all of these different setups. And we didn't have a clue what was going to kind of what the final configuration was until we got there.
There was just this moment where we closed the doors of the aerodrome in order to focus. Because you guys had built this lovely redundant system with four lasers.
Right.
That we focused at 150 yards or 50 yards.
50, yeah, is where we focused them. Yeah. But yeah, they worked out further.
And We couldn't see.
Well, so day one, I show up like early in the morning. I fly in and then drive up to the aerodrome.
Western, yeah.
And I didn't have it in my brain that like, oh, the first thing that we need to do is focus these lasers and that it would be daytime. Like the whole time change just didn't click as far as, you know, I'm like, oh yeah, I'll get there. We'll line them all up. I'll be great. Well, it was bright daylight out. And the problem with infrared is the sun is a great source of infrared, washes out everything. I mean, I have an infrared camera that I use to see the actual dots. And, you know, these things, you know, you have four
even
lasers.
That was non-trivial, even in the darkness of our the hangar.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's still a ton of light in there, even when it is, you know, closed up and whatnot. So we're looking for shadows and we're looking for like places where it's like, oh, there's a little less sunlight and you can kind of make it out. And the first test that we did actually wasn't aligned at all. And it was kind of just like close enough to go, I think that'll work. It's worth keep going.
Did you have that at the 100 yards to line
it? We did. Across the long diagonal of the hangar, we did.
Exactly. Okay. We got it mostly lined up enough to, again, prove it to ourselves that, like, okay, this is, you know, a path forward. We're not, like, completely dead in the water.
And that got our sequence of testing, but you guys came back. You guys stayed that evening once it got dark and did the final focus.
Exactly. So, yeah, we had a board that we put out, you know, way out on the runway, so that we actually got the full distance, and then got them all aligned. And you know, the idea is we wanted a spot that was large enough to kind of make up for the fact that there's individual sensors on the airplane, because we can't cover the, you know, entire airplane with sensors. But you know, in reality, if you shoot a bullet, if you happen to be anywhere near the person that isn't, it's going to probably do some damage. So there's kind of this balance of, like, okay, what's realistic as far as sort of a spot size versus the, you know, position of the sensors, and all of that kind of has to feed in together.
And we were able to do a sensored array where no tripping one sensor never triggered its neighbor, which was again mind blowing to me.
Yep. And the alignment of the sensors, that mechanical system, like, was there room for failure where they could be misaligned in flight?
The sensors had 180 degrees of reception.
I happen to have one right here. So there's actually a little dome. There's 9 infrared elements that actually pick up. So this would be like what's in your, you know, television that grabs the infrared signal from your remote. Same thing. It's got plastic coating on it that blocks a lot of the sunlight, but not all of it. So I made this little kind of array of them so that, you know, each one has a window of view. But if you have an array like this, you actually get basically 180 degrees.
So, and this is a custom board you built.
Custom board, yeah. Everything about this is custom. I mean, they're off-the-shelf individual parts, but they're all put together. So this gives you, you know, a complete hemisphere of view. So, you know, if you put one on one side of the plane, this is where kind of there was a learning thing for me when I went down to the test airplane in Texas. I hadn't really thought through of all the different angles that, you know, the plane could be hit at until I was standing in front of the airplane. Because originally when we first talked, it was like, we'll make like 4 or 5 sensors and put them on the airplane and that should be fine.
Yeah.
And then when I got down there, I was like, oh, wait a minute. The wings and the pilot and all of, you know, the tail and all these things block all these different angles. We need a lot more sensors. So it was kind of a number of steps to kind of get to that point.
And every sensor had to be, you also included opto-isolation within the circuit itself.
Well, because of all the interference, that was one of the big things. That was my huge worry from the kind of warning of the first meeting of, oh yeah, nothing electronic works around these things. And it's like, oh man, we've got to actually make something that works. So I threw every like trick in that I knew to isolate and protect the electronics, because, you know, this is an analog circuit. You're actually sending light beams and you're modulating them at frequencies, and there's, you know, a bandpass filter that, you know, makes sure that you only see those that filtered frequency. So it's actually a tuned circuit, and it's really easy to have a tuned circuit do bad things. It's not like a digital circuit that you can kind of just say, okay, only look for this. This is actually, there's a lot of analog components in here. So, it makes it more susceptible to RF interference. So, you know, everything from like having its own power supply. So every sensor has a 9-volt battery in there. And we wanted a big 9-volt battery so they'd last forever, so we wouldn't have to worry about batteries dying. This is a 4-layer board so that it's, you know, it's got some shielding kind of built in there. Lots of power supply filtering. There's a ton of different layers of, you know, sort of protection, and then opto isolation because we have these long cables which act as antennas.
Right. Every single sensor had to be hardwired to the central box through the plane. And there was this, one of my favorite developments over the course of the time we were there was that when we first showed up, they were of course very circumspect about allowing us near and inside and around the planes.
Yeah.
And then as they got to understand, and this is an incredibly wonderful, versatile team that loves these machines. Once they got used to and understood our process, we became far more simpatico and easy. Oh, yeah. And by the end, they were like, yeah, just route it anyway. You know what the important parts are.
Well, and it was amazing to work with them because I've never worked in a team that where everybody is so capable and competent. We're looking at these airplanes and we're trying to figure out places to put stuff. And, you know, there's little holes where, like, stitching is, and you can kind of feed wires through. But then there's, like, places, like, oh, on the bottom of the airplane, there's just nothing. There's this, like, metal panel, but it's smooth and flat. We can't attach
it. No zip ties.
Yeah, you can't zip tie to it. And one of the guys goes, oh, well, I'll just make you a new panel. And we're like, wait, what? Oh, and it seemed like minutes. Like, he just, like, went over to a little side shop and came back with a hand-cut, like, perfectly formed with the hinge mounts and everything.
Yep. This is Dave. I mean, that was Dave.
Dave,
and
yeah.
Just, I am a fast maker of things. Speed is one of my priorities. And when I meet someone who's faster than me, I am always kind of surprised. And Dave was twice as fast as I would ever be at the things he was doing. It's incredible.
And it didn't look fast.
No.
Like, it looked like the panel that was there, and it had the same exact curves and the bevels and the bends and every little part. And it's like, clearly he's a craftsman, but is also able to knock this stuff out so incredibly fast.
And that's a shop where they can build an entire plane from scratch if they need to.
And they do.
Yeah, this isn't the airplane factory where they build these planes. This is where they maintain them. Mm. So they can build one from scratch if they need to.
Yeah. So working with that team made it, I mean, just an amazing experience.
And I think they would say the same thing, right? Like, they got to understand our work ethic and our drive, and it became this lovely family by the end of the
show. It really was. I mean, I felt so close to everybody there. I mean, even just like the local... the local staff, as far as the production was concerned, like, we were so well taken care of, and like, oh, so, so good. Hmm. I mean, all of it was.
Sounds like New Zealand.
Exactly. That is. So this is my experience of New Zealand every time I go. That's why, one of the reasons I am so moved by how much I love
it. I don't know
country.
If I want to go back, because it's going to pale in comparison to that trip.
Well, the next thing that I want to do with you guys is more in the United States. And I don't know if Savage Builds will be picked up for a second season. If it is, this is the first episode I'm pitching them. Because it would be, and this is the only hint I'm giving, it would be replicating a machine that was built extensively in the 30s and the 40s that is super unstable, and we'd be making a new version, a stable version of said machine.
Mm, hopefully stable.
For an amazing, with an amazing collaborator. That's all I'm going to say.
Sounds great. Yeah. Sign me up.
And Jeremy, you were in the States getting the messages, hoping the boards that you had worked on.
Oh my gosh, I was on pins and needles. Yeah, because I was responsible for the other components, like the master, the hub in the center, and the interface for the pilots.
And you did the game software
and the code. And so I was just, you know, because I was like, what time is it in New Zealand? Right. And then wait, and then the whole day would go by, because it turns out you guys didn't shoot until kind of later in the day.
Yeah, often.
And
yeah.
Thank God, I finally got texts from Adam and Zach.
It was like 10 p.m. at night, your time, right? Yeah, and we're like, it works! And as many exclamation points as we feel like shoving in there.
As soon as I knew it, like, my family knew it. It was those were good moments.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, what a relief that everything just kind of gelled.
I always told Adam, like, if you ever want to build a laser gun toy, call me. But if you ever want to build a laser gun, call Zach. And then it actually happened.
Yeah.
So much fun. I really, the whole point of doing Savage Builds was that it was a we show, not a me show. Mm-hmm. That it was about the collaborators I got to play with every time, and with you guys, and with Peter Jackson and Tori Belleche and Jeff Pringle from the Meteorite Sword,
and
Gary
Simone
Oldman, Simone and Laura. In every way, every collaboration brought a kind of a wonderful, unique facet, revealed a wonderful facet about working together with people who you don't normally work with. And that, to me, is like the story I just want to keep on telling.
Mm-hmm. That really was magic. I mean, it really was.
We have a little bit of an epilogue, too, because we put out a video on Tested this week.
Oh, yes! Something that happened. Drawing.
Yeah, so as you were chatting with Peter about his collection of planes and the restoration of planes, he told you...
Well, he had a barn find of a plane that he had bought that had been sitting in the rafters of some British barn for decades and decades and decades, and he bought it. And one of the first things they do in a restoration is they peel off the canvas, which is never in a state that's flight-ready.
It rots.
Yeah, so they're peeling the canvas off, and inside the leading edge of one of the wings, they find this rolled-up drawing of a British officer. And Peter asked if I could crowdsource, using my platform, a solution to who that pilot might have been. And we put it up on YouTube and Twitter. And what was it? Less than 30 minutes?
Yeah. And within the first hour.
Within the first
people
hour.
People found the Wikipedia page. And it turns out it's a pilot, an ace, named Mick Manick, who, it's what we think.
Yeah.
And there's a
well, someone did a Photoshop of the drawing and of the famous photo of him, and they match perfectly.
Yes.
They one-to-one. The insignia, the outfit, the pose, the hair, everything is one-to-one.
Wow. And so the theory is that this may not have been his plane, but it may have been someone who admired him, or people's theories are that they, for good luck.
Like a little don't shoot me out of the sky mezuzah, exactly. Just to touch before you take off.
Yeah. They would. You know.
Well, and it turned into a time capsule. I mean, that's...
And that's the part that's really lovely. And you realize that's also part of why Peter loves these things. Because... And the whole point of the episode, it turned out, was I realized we made a time machine. Mm-hmm. We did something that no one's done in not 100 years, but maybe like 85 years. A real with some stakes included, dogfight in these planes. And understood things about them that aren't obvious from just flying them and just knowing about what their capabilities are.
It sounds like even to the pilots that you worked with, that was true.
Indeed. And I will tell you that the RE-8 with a gunner is very dangerous. They called them flying coffins, but I'm here to say that with a good pilot-gunner relationship, they were formidable enemies.
Now, Peter did say at the end, I remember, he said, well, rarely would you have only one Falker in the sky. There'd normally be six of them, and you'd have been toast in like 2 seconds. But if there happened to be only one, you probably would do okay.
And that's also very part of Peter's storytelling, is you come down out of the sky, and I show Peter pictures, and he's like scrolling through the pictures on my phone. He's like, oh, yeah, you're dead. Oh, yeah, that one, you're definitely dead.
Because if you can see them.
Yes, exactly. It is hard to overstate how those gas blowback aspect, which our armorer brought to this, which was like some map gas and a little relay that was bop, 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 bop.
And some oxygen.
And so I got to actually see muzzle flash from my opponents and hear the sound as I was generating.
Oh, and there, you even feel a little bit of that air pushback. I mean, you know, like
from my own gun.
From your own gun, absolutely.
Totally. So again, it upped the realism. And I'm really, really pleased with the episode. Like it shows our experience. The story is there.
It doesn't show me just giddy in the corner laughing every time I'm seeing this, just going like, this is the most amazing thing ever. But yes, absolutely.
One of my favorite things is the hero shot we shot of Peter with his cup of tea and his white shirt and just like coming through the doors of the aerodrome. Again, there's a generosity to his spirit about sharing transformative experiences, both through his movies and through his friendship that I find really inspiring.
Well, awesome.
We covered a lot there.
Woo, that was great.
Jeremy,
Zach. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Wait, you got to show the hit flash.
Oh, yes. So I didn't take much from the shoot, but I thought this would just go in the trash, so I brought this back. Yeah, this was our test rig. This is our test rig, so just to show, because it was actually hard to know from a distance that you've hit something, so we needed something physical to actually happen. So yeah, so this was a little servo that we threw on one of their little Jeep vehicles that when it hit, it popped up in kind of a fun way.
And so the Jeep vehicle was driving laterally across my field while I was trying to shoot at it and trying to also come up with a sight picture so that our guns were properly aimed, and it was hilarious seeing that little doink come up.
And it felt accurate.
What's that?
It felt accurate.
Very.
Wow.
Very.
That's very cool.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys for joining us today.
Pleasure.
Thank you for inviting us.
More adventures in the future.
Love it.
Absolutely. I will tease one thing on the site this week. We have a video of an unboxing. I think we teased on Instagram of three big boxes that you were very, very excited for.
I guess I'm out of it's out of the camera frame, isn't it?
Out of the camera frame.
Oh, yes. An addition to my collection that is a remarkable and amazing piece.
I'll be on the site later this week.
Big boxes are good.
Totally.
All right. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Bye.